The purpose of this show is solely to provide information for you to make your own decisions on the subjects that are presented.
Welcome to the Ben Armstrong Show. I'm so glad that you've joined me. This is not my normal setup studio. This is that I am on location at the New Americans headquarters in their real TV studio. So that's why it looks so much cooler than it normally does, because this studio is awesome and I wish that I had it permanently, but I don't. But anyways, I'm so glad and to have a guest with me today on this special episode of the Ben Armstrong Show. And it is Daniel Natale, which you, I'm sure, are aware of. If you are a regular watcher of my show, you know who Daniel is, and hopefully you check out his show as well. And what a lot of people don't know is how special this is. We don't get to see each other. We live in different states. And we just recorded a cool roundtable that you can also check out at thenewamerican.com, where me, Daniel, Zoe Warren, and Alex Newman were all together. We all live in different states. So it's you don't know how rare that is that we can get together, because you see us on the same website. So naturally, you would assume we see each other all the time. We actually don't. We don't ever get to see each other. So this is so special to me to have Daniel Natale here on my show. Daniel, welcome to the Ben Armstrong Show.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for having me. Yeah, and it is good. It's kind of like COVID when everybody got used to working at home. And now after that is receding a little bit and they're coming back to a central location. So that's how I kind of associate it with that. So yeah, it's good to see you, man.
Well, Daniel, America, I'm always warning, is not going in a good direction. But you know what's really cool is to get your perspective of where America's headed. And I always get to be the smartest guy in the room because I'm the only one in the room when I do my show. But now I'm not the smartest guy in the room. Daniel is the smartest. No. Oh, yeah, you're the smartest guy.
I love your material, man.
But I want your perspective of what's happening to America. Where are we headed?
One of the books that I've been reading lately, and I've been putting it in a lot of my presentations, is Herbert Spencer's Study of Sociology from 1873. And one of the things he says in there is that he basically describes the what we today call the Bader-Meinhof effect, where we think that if something is happening to us that is brand new, right? And the Bader-Meinhof effect is basically when something comes into your sphere of consciousness, you become conscious of it for the first time. So if you buy a new watch, only after buying it do you notice other people with that watch. If you get a yellow car, only then do you notice all the other yellow cars. And before then, it was like invisible to you. And he said one of the big cognitive errors that people make is that only when they become conscious of something do they suddenly think it sprang into existence. But in fact, it's been happening forever. They just weren't conscious of it. And the establishment basically manipulates kids, for example, with climate science. You know, and they in reality, it's happening in a cycle. Things get warmer, things get cooler. There are solar cycles. But if you're suddenly told, hey, the temperature is 0.1 of a degree high, this must just be happening. You know, and it creates panic but one of the things that makes you realize is that things happen in historical cycles, and that a lot of the stuff that we think is new that's happening now, these are part of larger cycles that have been happening. So a lot of people are very alarmist. They're you know, America is on the cusp of destruction and this, that, and the other. But I see a lot of hope, especially now. You know, it's always darkest before the dawn, et cetera. It's a cliche, but it's very much true. And I think that when you take a larger historical perspective, that you calm down. You stop hyperventilating because you realize, hey, this has happened before. We survived this. You know, what does not kill me makes me stronger. We got stronger from certain things. And despite all the negativity, you know, that even I engage in, I am generally heartened and white-pilled, especially being here with you guys, I mean, with the other hosts, and hearing a lot of what you had to say, you know, really is a cause for optimism. So,
well, my head always goes to the Bible, and what you're basically saying is there's nothing new under the sun, as the Bible says. There isn't, but people always think something's new. It's just like what we're seeing with the gay pride situation, that everyone thinks that this is a culture that is enlightened, and this is something new, when we've had plenty of cultures that fully embraced homosexuality, but the people think like, oh, we've evolved into some new enlightened society. So I'm worried in America about having safe elections. And I don't think I've really had any discussion with you about this, so I'm really curious on your thoughts. Can we even have non-rigged elections statewide? I know that we can have local, like when it's controlled by conservatives in a certain area, those are possibly going to be okay, possibly. But a statewide election where you have Democrats controlling massive areas and we see so much voter fraud, is it possible? Are we going to have safe elections? What's your thoughts on the whole election thing?
I just had a meeting today, and I was talking to some of the people up at the New American headquarters, and we were discussing this. And I was discussing the possibility of Americans taking back the Electoral College. That historically, the Electoral College was a bunch of delegates sent by the state legislatures, and they were the ones who chose our president, as an example. And that these representatives, that was the originally before 1824, for you to want to be a presidential candidate, you would pitch yourself to these state delegates. You wouldn't go to a political party. And after 1824, however, the corporations, the financial class, they created this fake electoral college called a political party that's not in our Constitution. And they started picking our raft of presidents. And months before the actual Electoral College, and by the time you get to the Electoral College, now it's just a rubber stamp and they don't actually choose anything. This is very unconstitutional. And I was talking to them about the possibility of, you know, perhaps creating an education campaign, an information campaign to say, hey, according to our Constitution, the people aren't supposed to be directly voting for the president at all. It's supposed to be the state, you know, legislatures sending delegates. The delegates, the electors elect the actual president. And if you actually went back to the constitutional system, then vote fraud becomes an irrelevancy because we're not supposed to be voting. Anyway, that's unconstitutional. That's totally unconstitutional. This system that is Republican and Democrat, George Washington warned about that. He said that we shouldn't even have political parties. Political parties were a traditional thing from England. And he said that this would immediately corrupt our constitutional system. And since 1824, you've seen this fake. Basically, it's the corporatization of our government, where all of a sudden you think, oh, well, this is the, you know, executive branch, and now it's the Coca-Cola branch. Or you think this is the judicial branch, and now it's the Walmart branch. Well, likewise, the Electoral College became the Republican branch or the Democrat branch. But these are actually shell companies for financial corporations. Like with, the Democrats discovered that when Bernie Sanders was, hustled from, you know, it was stolen from him, and they gave the nomination to Hillary Clinton, and they went into a court of law. They sued, and the courts said no. They don't, even if you vote for whoever you want, they're allowed. The party leadership is allowed to install anyone they want because it's a private corporation. They're under no legal obligation, and they learned for the first time, hey, wait, the Democratic Party is not part of our government. They're a private corporation. The Republican Party is not part of our government. Like the Koch brothers on the Republican side, the Koch organization, their organization, Americans for Prosperity, has three times the staff of the Republican National Committee. So the Republican National Committee is basically a shell company. Same thing with the Democrats on their side. So, I mean, we need to get back to the Constitution. If we do, it would solve so many problems. So it is possible technologically.
You see, folks, you see how awesome and the knowledge that Daniel comes with and comes from a different perspective. Like, I would have never even hit on those things. And this is why your show is so special, is because you're speaking truths, but there's truths that people don't understand. And they're even shocking truths because people don't think it's true at first. What you're saying is 100% true, but people don't think it and they don't understand why would the forefathers set it up that way. Just like we're a republic, not a democracy.
Yeah.
And people get confused about that. In fact, let me lead into that, because I want to hear your perspective on that, because you hear it so much. We're a democracy. We're a democracy. No, we're not. We're a republic. Explain the difference between that, a republic and a democracy.
Okay. In classical politics, they believed, you know, Plato, Aristotle, Cicero, they believed that there were three basic governmental systems: monarchy, aristocracy, and republic. And these had decayed forms. Monarchy would decay into tyranny, aristocracy would decay into oligarchy, and republic would decay into democracy. And the distinction between, you know, so basically, just right there, a democracy is not a good thing because it's the decayed state of a republic. A republic is essentially, think of it in terms of quantity versus quality, right? So a republic is quality representatives who actually know political science and know what they're doing. In a democracy, it's mob rule, so it's quantity. So even if it's a bad idea, if a majority of, you know, the people want a bad idea, then the bad idea has to be forced through. And this is why Ben Franklin famously said, you know, we don't want a democracy. A democracy is two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner. And so in a republic, another distinction would be a republic protects individual rights, right? The whole purpose of a republic, the whole, you know, mandate of it is individual rights. Whereas in a democracy, they believe in the collective rights. So you'll hear in these decayed states where they'll say, oh, well, you must take this shot. You must be medically experimented on for the common good. You know, oh, you want your freedom? How selfish of you to want that individual right. It's the common good, the collective, the Borg, the hive mind. And so that basically, Aristotle, when he described democracy, it's very clear he was saying what we describe as socialism today. The term socialism was only coined in the 1830s by a French philosopher. Aristotle, when he described a democracy, he said that in a time of democracy, demagogues would rise up, and these demagogues would manipulate the people. They would bribe their way into power by offering free food, free housing, free healthcare. He actually says this in Politics. So he's describing, you know, somebody getting stuff for free, promising free stuff to the people. He gets into power, he takes over. And, you know, basically, when the French Revolution happened, the communists, they said, yes, this is a democracy. This is what we're for. This is socialism. You know, so this was their word. And the very first people that the Bolsheviks, they put up a statue to Robespierre, the leader of the French Revolution. And they said, yes, the people in the French Revolution who wanted democracy, these were the forerunners of the communists, of the Bolsheviks. And he was absolutely right. That is what democracy is. And this is why the political left always promotes democracy, because it means socialism.
See, you're like a walking history lesson. It's so fantastic. And you don't have notes in front of you. You just pull these things just off the top of your head. You've got a great memory. I know you're well read and you get a lot of information from that, but it's really amazing. So somebody might be saying, okay, so you're saying a republic is what we're supposed to be and you're trying to say it's better, but I hear there's the People's Republic of China, which is communism and People's Republic of China. Yeah. And they're calling that a republic. Explain, how is that even possible? How are the communists calling themselves a republic?
That's not even a republic. It's a one-party state. In no way, shape, or form is that a republic. It's essentially a technocracy. It's not even a communist state either. It's a modern technocracy. And since, you know, the 1950s, it's been a sandbox. It's been beta testing for stuff that would later be rolled out in the West. And we're seeing this now with tech companies going over there with social credit systems and helping them, you know, do surveillance and warrantless spying and all this stuff. And then they're coming back to the West and bringing these techniques. Well, that's been, you know, the case since the 1950s. I mean, China has been a brutal, ruthless, totalitarian state. I just did a presentation on what's the difference between a dictatorship and a totalitarian state. And I didn't know this until recently. I never thought about it. But I was reading James Burnham's Managerial State from 1941. And Burnham makes a good point. He says that every society has different institutions, right? There's the government is one institution, religion is another institution, media, academia, marriage. These are all different institutions and they relate to the public in different ways. And he said, in a dictatorship, you have an authoritarian controlling only one institution, government. But he's not controlling any of the others. He's just controlling government. In a totalitarian state, it's one group, one person or group controlling every institution. So you have them controlling, you know, the economy, you have them controlling the government, you have them controlling the schools, you have them controlling, you know, media, everything across the bandwidth. So China really is a totalitarian state. They don't have separation of church and state. They don't have a you know, like for instance, Henry VIII. When Henry VIII took over the church in England, he kicked out the Catholics and he founded the Anglican Church. He became both the head of the government and the head of the church. You know, that was the, you know, getting toward a totalitarian state for that time period. But he didn't have the technology to control the rest of it. China did. And so China is really, I mean, one of the first purely totalitarian states. And unfortunately, a lot of their techniques are being rolled out now that, you know, technology is allowing for a technocracy to be possible. So,
well, that leads me into another question about big tech. So I'd love to get your views on that. We see big tech in America really going along with they're really just an arm of the government, what it seems like to me. They're just the way the government can get around censoring us what they want to do, and they're just using private companies to do it for them, but they're doing it at the instruction of the government. Mm-hmm. But the dangers of big tech, what can we do to even combat this? Do you see us winning in this situation? Do conservatives just keep developing their alternative? Is that going to be able to defeat that? What's your thoughts on all of that stuff?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Somebody made the comment the other day about something to that effect where they were talking about how most of the, I think it was an article by Pepe Escobar, and he was talking just an offhand comment where he said that most of big tech's technology came from the military. George Friedman from Stratford does that. He very effectively holds up his cell phone. He's like, every component of the cell phone is from the military. It's from war. He was like, the camera in it was for spying cameras. He was like, the GPS in it was for guided missiles. The little chip in it was also for missiles, for intercontinental ballistic missiles. He was like, this is a product. Steve Jobs did not invent this. Any component of this technology. He got like, you know, things that were, that the military had open. The military can't patent things. So people from the industrial sector will go in, take some of these things, put it together and market it, and they're really good at marketing. But in reading that comment, you know, by Pepe Escobar, I was like, you know, stunned, because it never occurred to me that so much of big tech is military, is DARPA. The internet, you know, was originally a DARPA program. Cell phones, all this surveillance stuff is the military. So in a weird sense, in a weird way, it's almost like a military coup has taken place. And a lot of these corporations are actually just shell companies for older DARPA programs, like Facebook with LifeLog, the DARPA program LifeLog. And, you know, all these companies, Patrick Byrne said that. He's the CEO of Overstock.com.
LifeLog, I don't mean to cut you off. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about that. What is LifeLog?
That was a DARPA program, a military program, to basically create files on people, on every citizen. How would you get them to create a CIA file on themselves, a control file? And so they were working on that, and it stopped the very day, literally the day that Facebook was founded. So that program Wow. went and morphed, you know. So people, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg, if you research this, is very suggestive as to whether he's an actor, you know, fronting this. I mean, the whole narrative of, you know, oh, just college kids, just randomly. And then when you look at the technology of it and you look at the history of it, a lot of these, like Patrick Byrne said that of Overstock.com, I was just mentioning that. He said that he was approached by people within the FBI and CIA, and they said, we can make you a billionaire. You know, just play ball with us. We'll send government contracts your way. And we'll build up your company, but your company will basically be a shell company. We're going to run operations that, you know. And so a lot of people have taken that deal, a lot of entrepreneurs, if you're approached, you know, and all you've got to do is, you know, create backdoors into your software. All you've got to do is, you know, create surveillance, you know, things and share that with the government, and you can be very rich. China's making that deal, I mean, you know, with these tech entrepreneurs, you know, come to our country, help us do this technocratic system, you know, and we will throw contracts your way. We have 1.4 billion people. We'll help you get really rich, but you're going to help us lock down our totalitarian society. And you asked something, is there hope? Do we create? I think the hope is creating a parallel economy, creating parallel technologies, creating parallel platforms. And you see the breakdown of their system, like when they were monolithic, when Facebook ruled the world, or when YouTube ruled the world. And then they shot themselves in the foot through censorship, through deplatforming people. And all of a sudden you saw this fragmentation. And with that fragmentation comes a loss of power. So we're already seeing the process of this parallel economy and social system, you know, or reorganizing. And I think that's very white pilling. So.
Yeah. And the fragment of that social media, you see that. I'm just thinking about what we're doing right here is kind of the same thing with the media. The fragmentation of the media, creating all this alternative media, and it's scattered and it's all over the place. But that actually shows the loss of power the media has, which is showing why so many people, when you poll them, are saying they're sick of the Democrat Party. They hate Joe Biden. When I was a kid, you could only get your media from one source. So that fragmentation of the media is giving us hope too. The problem is, as we get stronger, they're going to get more desperate, and they're going to and because you're so well read in history, I want your thoughts on using historical knowledge. What is the next step that they're going to do if they see that, okay, our social media companies are rising way more than they thought would happen? Our alternative media is becoming stronger than they thought. what will their response be?
There's a great book called Pawns in the Game. William Guy Carr, I think, was the author in the 50s. He was Canadian, and he wrote a history of all these revolutions that happened. And they stick pretty close to the template. For instance, Oliver Cromwell, when he takes over England and he beheads Charles I, creates the alleged English Republic, and he's the Lord Protector of the English Republic. And he was financed by the banks in continental Europe. Turns out that Charles had seized the gold from the bank, and he did legitimately steal the gold. He's running short of funds. These funds, I should be able to steal these as king. The people who own the gold disagreed, and so they created a color revolution. They financed Oliver Cromwell. Oliver Cromwell comes in, kills people. They get their gold back. And so you see the same template that was used in the French Revolution. You saw, financiers basically staged, they wanted to get rid of all the crowned heads of Europe, and they wanted to replace them with governments that they could corrupt more easily. They love democracies, not big fans of republic, but they love democracies because they're so bribable, they're so incoherent. And so they did that in the French Revolution too. They caused destabilization. They opened up the prisons, the Bastilles, right? They encouraged criminals to go out to kill people to create a distraction. And one of the things that they did was they caused a famine. They caused a synthetic famine. And right now you're seeing the collapsing of the supply chains.
Right.
A synthetic famine happens. That's the bad part. That's the darkness, the storm. But there is a light after, that breaks. Usually these things burn themselves out, they collapse, and then there's a restoration. Like after Oliver Cromwell died, the restoration happened. Charles II comes in, the Republicans are destroyed. Part of that is our history as Americans. A lot of those people who fought the king fled to the American colonies not to get killed after the restoration happened. And that's why we have all of our, ideals of republics and stuff, which is awesome. I love a real republic. I don't like a democracy. But anyway, the French Revolution followed that pattern. The Spanish Civil War followed that pattern where they caused a synthetic famine shortage to soften up the population, make them desperate, and then they give their solution. Come to our authoritarian side and we'll give you food. They did that in the Ukraine. The Soviets did that in the Ukraine with their famine there, synthetic famines. So I do see where they according to the template, they are going to be very inclined toward creating disruptions in supply chains, creating shortages and creating desperation among the people. But as I said, these things usually collapse, they fall apart, and then afterwards the people reassert themselves. The old governmental system is swept away, but you get to, once that detritus is swept away, the people reemerge. And from, the collapse of England, we get the United States. From the collapse of the French Republic, you got the restoration and you got more, stable government after the French Revolution. That burned itself out. All the leaders of the French Revolution ended up in the guillotine. So the left eats its own. So this process is...
I got to stop you there because I'm running out of time. But it's amazing. Those who survive the situation,
yeah,
there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
It's really...
Yeah, well...
That's how we have to look at it. But it is what... It's the truth. That's why I asked you, because I knew you could bring history into it. Folks, do you see why the Daniel Natal show is so awesome? Do you see how he comes at things differently than anybody... really on the planet? It's awesome. And the knowledge that Daniel has, you got to check out the Daniel Natal show. This is part one. And in part two on Friday on Daniel's Natal show, he's going to interview me and you can check that out. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through him. I love you guys. See ya. Hey guys, have you ever checked out the Daniel Natal show at thenewamerican.com? If you haven't, you need to. It's very highly intellectual. It's very unique in the way that it comes at the issues of the day. If you put me and Daniel in the same room, Daniel's the smartest guy in the room. Daniel's probably the smartest guy in the room in almost most rooms that he enters. So check out the Daniel Natal show. It is really cool. You will like it. Check it out at thenewamerican.com.